This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com.
So, you know, for those of you who didn't know, February is Black History Month. I actually feel like there hasn't been that much activity this month, except for Black Panther, right? And I don't know if you all know this, but Black Panther, I think, has topped $700 million at the box office. And there's still a lot more coming in if we think about the international market. And it looks like Black Panther is going to be poised to, you know, outdo both Spider-Man and Wonder Woman in terms of box office receipts. And so one of the things that people have been saying about Black Panther is that maybe now this will finally prove to Hollywood and beyond that there actually are people who would be willing to watch movies that are made by Black filmmakers with primarily, if not all, Black cast. And it's not necessarily risky to invest in such an undertaking.
Well, first of all, have you seen the movie yet? I haven't
seen
it.
I didn't see it because I want to be a good ally and allow a black space for black audiences. And I'll catch you on the second weekend.
Did you see that tweet?
Yeah, it was ridiculous. No, I mean, I actually would like to see it this coming weekend, but, you know, I wasn't, like, you know, allowing the space for it.
I just can't get a free night to watch a movie. But yeah, exactly. did you see this woman's tweet? I don't want to change the topic, but very quickly, this one, I was on Twitter. It was this well-meaning woman who said she didn't want to go to the premiere night so as not to interfere in the black joy, I think it was.
Oh my goodness.
And she got roasted. Roasted on the.
What is that? What does that mean? Does that mean that white people kill all the black joy in the world?
I think that's the level that she was getting roasted on. They're like,
that's kind of crazy. Yeah. And also kind of self-centered. I mean, I'm just like, we're not looking at you, lady.
Anyway, but back to your actual point, right? I mean, there has been a lot of, you know, films starting in the 70s and 80s with black stars, especially action films. Something, you know, the director is kind of a new thing. I mean, there have been major black directors before, but, you know, the idea of a large action film from a major franchise, but kind of its own thing, even though it's loosely tied into a big franchise with a black lead, you know, and it being very successful, that is relatively new.
Here's a question. Why should blackness limit your ability to direct competently?
I mean, it shouldn't. Yeah. But wait a minute. Hold on. What's this? Like, what about Will Smith? I love Will Smith.
Well, that's
Smith.
What I'm saying. Is like that there's a long history of black movie stars, right? Will Smith was the highest paid movie star in the world for like a decade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Eddie Murphy was probably one of the biggest movie stars of the 1980s. So, you know, in that respect, I think it's a historical amnesia and people kind of like having like an obsession with things being first and ignoring precedence. Mm-hmm. Kind of like when Sam Smith was saying like he was one of the first gay artists to gain recognition. And he's like, okay, you only believe that because you're 19 years old, right?
I mean, yeah, you know. And also too, if you even think about the success of actors like Will Smith, right? I mean, were they in movies where everyone else in the cast was black as well?
I think the only example would be like Coming to America, which was an almost entirely black cast and was one of the biggest films of the 80s and still worth watching.
One of the greatest
movies. Best films of all time. I'm not even, is not sarcastic at all.
Yeah, we were just talking about this at ESS, Becky, right?
Yep.
Trading Places is another favorite.
Anytime either of those is on, I have to watch them to completion.
Well, Trading Places has some third act problems, but Coming to America is hilarious from start to finish.
It's like a perfect movie.
It kind of is. Oh my God. Well, yes, basically, I mean, there's that. And also the question whether or not in some ways Black Panther's box office success might translate into, I don't know, people's willingness to think of Black people as worthy of taking quote unquote risks on? Because it seems to me that the director was not a risky investment. I mean, he did Fruitvale Station, he did Creed, they're both critically acclaimed films. And, you know, the buzz was that they were like, Hollywood's taking a risk.
Well, that is kind of the typical pattern where you have somebody make small movies that are very successful, then they get recruited into the big budget comic book movies. You saw the same thing with James Gunn, who did the Guardians of the Galaxy
right?
movies.
And did people think of that as being a risky endeavor?
I don't remember. I wasn't reading that particular issue of Variety.
You know what I wonder? I wonder if the success of the movie will somehow de-blackify it. You know what I mean?
Nah, I think what it might do is it might like hyper-blacken it.
One of the great joys of being on kind of the right of center internet is there's this running gag that was started by John Lasseter, the Weekly Standard, and then got picked up by Sonny Bunch at the Washington Free Beacon, basically arguing the opposite position of a movie. Like John Lasseter started this by arguing that actually the Empire were the good guys in Star Wars.
Yeah,
and then Sonny
that.
Bunch picked that up and it's always fun to enjoy them. So there's been a lot of that on Black Panther with this sort of thing. So like I heard people talking about like, well, you know, how does it have the resource curse? Because typically when you see a country that has an endowment of natural resources, it doesn't lead to a technologically advanced utopian paradise. It leads to civil war as people struggle for control of the rents that you can derive, right? You don't get Wakanda, you get Saudi Arabia. And anyway, other people have expressed that in a more amusing fashion than I just did. And then the really contrarian one is pointing out that, you know, this is a totally isolationist state, at least in the backstory, not necessarily going, you know, by the time the movie ends. But it's a totally isolationist state based on cutting itself off from the world. Nobody goes in, nobody goes out. And in this respect, it's a monarchy. In fact, it's actually like giving an extremely reactionary view of politics.
Yeah, well, you know what? Maybe that's what we need, right? I mean, I think about this all the time. I think about countries that are, you know, quote unquote, developing countries, right? And, you know, and it's sort of like, yeah, and our ambition is to be just like the developed world. Our ambition is to, you know, embrace capitalism. Our ambition, and part of me is like, you know what? Maybe you need to be doing your own thing, right?
Well, that's kind of what much of the developing world did.
Import substitution, right?
That's exactly what it was. And what they tried to do was seal themselves off. And what ended up happening was a lot of the barriers that were placed on exchange created a domestic elite that ended up also taking advantage of the country. And they ended up getting a lot of policies that weren't sustainable. There were some definite gains during that area. But on the whole, I think it doesn't pan out.
Does it pan out when you have a wealth of natural resources that you can exploit yourself rather than letting other people exploit?
Well, the problem is in a lot of countries, what happens is the local elites turn out to be just as exploitative as anybody else. And the resource curse, like the version of the resource curse that I'm familiar with, isn't that there's civil war, but that somebody gains control of the territory and the people who sit on top of the resources are a nuisance.
But isn't part of the reason why the local elites do that, it's because they learned it from their previous colonizers.
I don't think human beings need the example of other human beings to learn about war and exploitation. That's kind of endemic to human societies. But, you know,
that's a huge claim, Gabriel.
Well, yeah, but I've read War Before Civilization by Keeley, which is a fantastic book. He goes through all these arguments that historians have made about that you don't have war until you see the reactive state making against war making states. And he points out that the archaeology doesn't support that at all. That if you look at the archaeology, you see all sorts of evidence of pre-state massive levels of warfare. And to a certain extent, you also see that in the ethnography. But with this issue of like the import substitution, things like that, if you think about it, what the movie seems to be depicting is import substitution and natural resource endowment. And I don't think those two ever really go together because a natural resource endowment of a raw material is going to create huge comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. Right. And so a country that had a large natural resource endowment would be the last place you'd expect to see adopt import substitution. Those are exactly the countries you expect to see trade.
Well, I think the goal during that era was to use the gains from their valuable resource exports and try to build up a domestic industry.
Yeah, like when the Soviet Union took all the grain from the kulaks and used it to build steel factories.
Yeah, like stuff like that. I think it's this idea that you try to have your cake and eat it too. But the problem is that if you want access to other people's markets, then you have to, you know, sort of open yourself up. Mm-hmm. I mean, otherwise, let's say a country like Saudi Arabia or Iran was completely sealed off from the world. Well, that oil would be far less valuable in some ways, right? Like, yeah, you could burn it off to do other type of energy consumption activities, but you wouldn't be able to trade it for like foreign technology.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why a Wakanda type situation is unlikely, that a country with a natural resource endowment would be, you know, a relatively open market. It wouldn't be autarkic.
Well, I think that's given the way that the arc of history went. I think that we can think about alternative versions of development and thought. I mean, I think that that's actually, full disclosure, I haven't seen Black Panther yet either, but I actually,
Wait, how many of us have seen it? No. So or is it four people discussing it
funny
and haven't
story,
seen it?
Funny story, I went to see Black Panther, it was sold out, and ended up seeing Lady Bird instead. So.
Okay, so you get half credit. At least you get points for effort, whereas the rest of us are just totally talking out of our asses.
Yeah, no. Part of the logic underpinning the film is that, you know, because of its isolationist nature, you know, this like different ideas about development, different ways of living, right? And different ways of being quote unquote successful as a nation were able to develop that weren't necessarily these Western ideas of development.
Sure. And it makes sense as kind of literature and, you know, a myth, not necessarily in the sense of something that evolved as an oral thing, but nonetheless is kind of like a written myth. It makes sense in that kind of like emotional way thematically. But we can also be very pedantic and pick it apart and show how it's weird macroeconomics.
Yeah, well, just like we could pick apart Spider-Man and say, you know what, I don't think a spider biting you would give you the power to, you know.
You shut your mouth, listen.
I know. I'm just saying, you know, like I kind of feel like in the spirit of all what I think of as really good sci-fi, you have this world that, you know, it's like in the real world as we know it would never exist, but allows us to imagine a different today, right? And a different future.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of The Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.